Penguin Random House Audio presents How to Be an Anti-Racist. This is the author, Ibram X. Kendi. Preface to the paperback edition. Being anti-racist is a journey, not a destination. This book has been on its own journey since it was first published on my birthday, August 13, 2019. Much has changed about the world and me since then, and thereby some elements needed to change in this paperback edition to reflect all that I've seen, researched, and learned since 2019. Still, I agonized, first over whether I should update the book at all, and then over how transparent I should be about the updates. Since its initial publication, this book has attracted the attention of people whose interest is in delegitimizing anti-racism so they can legitimize racism, or their unproven conception of racism, or their flattering conception of themselves. Many of these people are suspicious about the book's success. After all, if a book on being anti-racist by a black scholar becomes a global bestseller, surely it can't be because the book is useful or compelling. After the experience of the last 3 years, it does not feel safe for me to be publicly self-reflective and self-critical. It feels dangerous for me to be vulnerable, just as it can be dangerous to be anti-racist and challenge the power and policy structure of racism. But in the end, I decided I didn't fear those dangers as much as I fear other dangers. What happens if we don't strive to be anti-racist? What happens if we allow racism to continue to spread like a cancer? What happens if we allow racist power to continue to get a fascist foothold? What happens to you, to me, to all we hold dear? White supremacy is the greatest domestic threat to American lives and the life of democracy in the United States. Racism, and bigotry more broadly, is an existential threat to humans across the world, like nuclear war, climate change, and pandemics. The real danger lies in us not challenging racism. It is even more dangerous for us not to strive to be anti-racist. It is even more dangerous for us, for me, not to be vulnerable and self-critical, to find our flaws, and to grow. I decided to update this new edition, including data whenever possible, refine the notes section, and expand it with more sources. But I also decided to show, in critical moments in the text, how my scholarly ideas have changed or become more precise. Chris Jackson, my editor, and I came up with the idea to show this through annotations. The introduction and chapter one, which frame the book, have the most annotations. The rest of the chapters typically have one or two, until they trail off in the final three chapters. Amid all the changes, much has remained the same about me, the world, and thereby this book. I still seek to magnify, define, and clarify the complexities and forms of racism and anti-racism. It still weaves this growing clarity with a chronological and vulnerable narrative of my own individual experiences, either reinforcing or challenging the structure of racism. It still replaces the fixed binary of not racist or racist with the peelable descriptors of anti-racist and racist. It retains the non-binary of anti-racist, assimilationist, and segregationist. It retains the double focus on readers of color and white readers, on individual transformation for societal transformation, because powerful forces are still striving to conserve racism. I am still on this journey, still striving to be anti-racist each day, but I am not on this journey for me. We are not on this journey by ourselves. This anti-racist work is collective work. This collective work is essential work. This essential work is liberatory and constructive work. Being anti-racist, to liberate humanity from the clutches of racist power. Being anti-racist, to construct an equitable, habitable, and just society. Ibram X. Kendi. My racist introduction. I despised suits and ties. For 17 years, I had been surrounded by suit-wearing, tie-choking, hat-flying church folk. My teenage wardrobe hollered the defiance of a preacher's kid. It was January 17th, 2000. More than 3,000 black people, with a smattering of white folks, arrived that Monday morning in their Sunday best at the Hilton Memorial Chapel in Northern Virginia. My parents arrived in a state of shock. Their floundering son had somehow made it to the final round of the Prince William County Martin Luther King Jr. oratorical contest. I didn't show up with a white collar under a dark suit and matching dark tie like most of my competitors. I sported a racy golden brown blazer with a slick black shirt and bright color-streaked tie underneath. The hem of my baggy black slacks crested over my creamy boots. I'd already failed the test of respectability before I opened my mouth, but my parents, Carol and Larry, were all smiles nonetheless. They couldn't remember the last time they saw me wearing a tie and a blazer, however loud and unconventional. Note on unconventional. I changed crazy to unconventional. Crazy is too often used in ableist fashion to identify anyone or anything abnormal, as I did here. My expertise lies in racist language. I'm still learning to identify my own ableist language, terms like crazy and stupid and dumb, and to catch myself before using these terms and others. I replaced quite a few ableist terms for this paperback edition. I'm striving to clean out all forms of bigotry from my vocabulary. It is striking how many terms we routinely use that are dirtied by bigotry. But it wasn't just my clothes that didn't fit the scene. My competitors were academic prodigies. I wasn't. I carried a GPA lower than 3.0. My SAT score barely cracked 1,000. Colleges were recruiting my competitors. I was riding the high of having received surprise admission letters from the two colleges I half-heartedly applied to. A few weeks before, I was on the basketball court with my high school team, warming up for a home game, cycling through layup lines. My father, all 6'3" and 200 pounds of him, emerged from my high school gym's entrance. He slowly walked onto the basketball court, flailing his long arms to get my attention and embarrassing me before what we could call the white judge. Classic dad. He couldn't care less what judgmental white people thought about him. He rarely, if ever, put on a happy mask, faked a calmer voice, hid his opinion, or avoided making a scene. I loved and hated my father for living on his own terms in a world that usually denies black people their own terms. It was the sort of defiance that could have gotten him lynched by a mob in a different time and place, or lynched by men in badges today. I jogged over to him before he could flail his way right onto our layup lines. Weirdly giddy, he handed me a brown manila envelope. "This came for you today." He motioned me to open the envelope right there at half court, as the white students and teachers looked on. I pulled out the letter and read it. I had been admitted to Hampton University in Southern Virginia. My immediate shock exploded into unspeakable happiness. I embraced Dad and exhaled, tears mixed with warm-up sweat on my face. The judging white eyes around us faded. I thought I wasn't smart enough for college. Of course, intelligence is as subjective as beauty, but I kept using so-called objective standards, like test scores, to judge myself. No wonder I sent out only two college applications, one to Hampton and the other to the institution I ended up attending, Florida A&M University. Fewer applications meant less rejection.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?